First of all, where are you calling from and how has this lockdown been for you?
Well, we are calling from Bozeman, Montana, and lockdown has very much been strange, but odd as it is for a couple of nature lovers to say, the technology afforded by things like Zoom has allowed us to continue to do presentations with college classes and events for different nonprofit conservation groups and so forth. So we feel like we're able to stay in touch, but we really do miss the opportunity to be in the same space as other people. There's just nothing quite like that.
And then I would say, this is Mary, I would say that there is a kind of uptick, and it's getting more acute as time goes by, in thinking about beloved friends all around who are more and less vulnerable. I think of my mom in Georgia, and I think of my friend Tyler, who I've known since he was 5, I think, African-American man who drives a bus in Seattle. You know, and sometimes I find that the narrative of these uncertain times can get quite compelling.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, speaking with Gary Ferguson about his book, The Eight Master Lessons of Nature, What Nature Teaches Us About Living Well in the World. He's also joined by Dr. Mary M. Clare, who happens to be his wife. You won't want to miss this conversation. I want to start by talking about the book before we get into your work with Full Ecology. And Gary, this book is called A Riveting Manifesto for the Millions of People Who Long to Forge a More Vital, Meaningful Connection to the Natural World to Live a Better, More Fulfilling Life. And you speak about the idea that humans tend to think of ourselves as standing outside of nature. And you actually write this: from that locus, it's all too easy to end up passive toward, disconnected from, and even bored by the earth. So can you just remind us, how did we get here, and how do we justify this position serving us?
Well, we do have a natural inclination, we being humans, for connection and for relationship. We've made some questionable decisions along the way that puts that particular genetic capacity, if you will, on the back burner. We really only have to look at early science in the late 1500s and 1600s with men like René Descartes and others who were just so overcome with enthusiasm for so-called subject-object thinking, reductionist thinking. And while that proved to be a remarkably useful way to understand the world and to harness some of the energies of the world at large for technologies that we depend on, we came to believe that that sort of isolation, that separation where we're disconnecting ourselves from what we're studying and we're disconnecting what we're studying from everything else so that we can better isolate it and understand it, that's all well and good, but it's a very limited tool, and it's not the truth. And in fact, we ended up being so enamored of that way of understanding the universe that we built our educational systems, our economies, our philosophies, and even some aspects of our religion on this notion of separation, of isolation, of reducing, when in fact you really only have to look at the world around us, and biology and ecology is flooded right now with are flooded with these fantastic discoveries of just how deeply related we are with one another, but also with all the life on this planet. We don't have the option to opt out of the the qualities that make for a good life on planet Earth, because we are nature too.
In the book, you advocate for this shift in perspective, right? That we are nature too. And the word humility came to mind, that, you know, nature really is our greatest teacher. And I was hoping you could make a statement about what would it mean, how would it actually benefit us to shift our sense of primacy?
Well, the notion that we're separate, again, this is in part the legacy of how we came to build our scientific practices, that really is a very lonely place to live, on this notion that I'm just this isolated object in a wild and woolly universe of isolated objects. It tends to promote a kind of zero-sum thinking where I've got to get mine, and the best way for me to get mine is to make sure that you don't get so much that I'm compromised. You know, it really sets us at odds with one another. Whereas the cultures who are and have been steeped in the natural world understand the folly of that. There, you know, it's really right now incredibly difficult for science, and by that I mean biology, to say where you end and where the rest of the world begins. We walk outside and the infrared from the sun is what sets the melatonin levels so we can sleep at night. It builds our bones by giving us vitamin D. We walk under trees and they emit not just the oxygen we need, but phytoncides, which are chemicals that fortify our immune system and our heart. We have trillions of microbes living in our bodies that came to live with us after we were born that are protecting us from pathogens that could harm us, that they're digesting our food and releasing that energy to our brains and our bodies. So we really are, just the biological truth of the situation is that we are connected. And what happens to one of us does indeed happen to us all. And one of the great opportunities of this book and my work with Mary in Full Ecology as well is to not just stand in awe of what nature does, but once we remember that we too are nature, to figure out how the lessons about how the natural world thrives can be incorporated more deeply into how we go about our daily lives.
Right, and clearly we are given ample opportunity to re-examine those relationships right now. Gary, I was hoping that you would just toss us into the book by reading the first couple pages.
Coming home. There was a time long ago when the supple reach of trees and the whisper of water bore deep comfort. When the ringing of birds and the mutter of frogs reminded us to take heart in the fact that whatever else was happening, we were all still here, rising strong in the morning, faces to the sun. We knew the juice of spring then, surging in the wild rose and the fig, and in us too. We could feel it as if we were somehow wed to the tender shoots, as if our own breathing was the great green breath of earth. A time when a person barely knew where she ended and the world began. The shouts, the songs, the purring and the whirring, all of it an astonishing conversation. From where we stand now, it can seem like a dream. But every so often, out of nowhere, the thrill of that old dance judders in our bones. It reawakens sensations we had within easy reach when we were young, still wide-eyed for the world. My own inklings of such things came during a boyhood spent in the Midwest, in a small city in northern Indiana, nursed on corn and casseroles and steel, a place where nature got served in teaspoons, a garden behind our house about the size of two couches laid end to end, where I first stood barefoot and watched the comings and goings of butterflies and bees, a slim ribbon of grass where in the twilight of summer I scurried about with a jam jar, scooping up lightning bugs, and the sidewalks of 27th Street, walking home from school on some gloomy April afternoon with the wind in the maples, thrilling to big booms of thunder thunking inside my chest. Around age 11, I started riding my purple stingray 10 blocks west of Pottawatomie Park, a place laced with lines of oaks and maples with trunks so big I couldn't reach even halfway around them. And nearby, a greenhouse with a banana tree and orchids and an avocado tree, and next to that, a pocket zoo with a geriatric lion, 6 crowing peacocks, a display of roaches, really, and a snorting donkey. As I have in adulthood spent some 40 years waltzing through some of the world's wildest places, drifting along more than 30,000 miles of trail through the outback, you might imagine I'd think of these modest encounters with nature when I was young as, well, quaint. But no, they were big, in their own way as vital as the yawning savannas of East Africa, or the high lonesome roll of the Yellowstone backcountry, or the cold, quiet reaches of the Arctic tundra. The lightning bugs and the bees and the giant oaks at Pottawatomie Park are what cracked me open, what introduced me to the ebb and flow of the world, to the daily playlist of chirps and buzzes and snorts and whooshes. Not just piquing my curiosity, but also leaving me with the extraordinary sensation of being part of it all. The chrysanthemums in the flower box under my bedroom window were somehow set to my own bright sense of summer. The cardinal in our maple tree wore a dazzling feathered suit that was my color of red. The mourning dove in the apple tree beside Carl and Yvonne Wilson's driveway cooed a song that even on first hearing was somehow familiar, reassuring. No matter who you are, or where as a child you happen to live, more than likely you too took some of your first steps toward growing up and growing out because nature charmed you into the precious work of unfolding. Whether it comes in big helpings of the wild or as a spider web in the corner of your garage or even as dandelions growing out of the cracks in the sidewalk, nature calls to each of us.
The first lesson in the book you name is mystery. Why start there?
I think that we, as a culture, in this country at least, have, in the quest for certainty and being able to predict how things will go, as if we could do that at all, have cut ourselves off from the joy of mystery. You know, Elaine Scarry at Harvard University talks about the power of beauty in the natural world to move us off center stage. So when we see something beautiful in nature, suddenly that movie that we're continually filming and editing about me, the movie of me, stops for a while, and we get to move off center and just simply watch something marvelous and full of wonder unfolding that we're connected to, but that we're not really in charge of. It is a way, I think, through mystery to invite humility and quiet, and from that state to really discover a deep kind of kinship that too often for too many of us is out of reach.
And in lesson 2, life on Earth thrives thanks to a vast garden of connections. You write, after hundreds of years, we're finally beginning to shed the illusion that we have the natural world in our hands, slowly but surely replacing it with the far more accurate, more comforting truth that in so many ways the world has our backs. And that struck me, thinking about here we are in the time of COVID when lots of people could easily say, nature does not have our backs. Nature is actively trying to kill our species. Gary, how do you respond to that?
Well, I think COVID does invite in this shelter-in-place time when we're all hopefully having a little bit more reflective opportunity open up to us to ask what our relationship with the natural world really is. And you can answer that on a lot of levels, but do keep in mind that For instance, climate change has resulted in setting into motion species out of their traditional habitats, seeking places that are more friendly to them. And this includes things like mosquitoes carrying all kinds of dangerous diseases. And sometimes it includes mammals as well. At the same time, we're harvesting bush meat from places where humans have not really been before. We're encroaching on the last wild places, cutting down the trees, burning those former forests and creating agricultural fields. Again, squeezing us up against animals that typically we've had some boundaries from. And so as that concentration happens, we're around those pathogens that some of the animals carry much more frequently than we were before. Of course, the wild markets, the wildlife markets, the so-called wet markets that thrive around the world, many of them illegal, is another way that we go into wild places, extract wild animals, and then bring them into direct contact with humans. So for all of those reasons, this isn't a suggestion that we need to flog ourselves for such mistakes, but we really do increasingly, I think, have to take responsibility for how we're living and how those decisions have set us up for some of these pandemics that really were not quite as riskier. There weren't as many of them threatening us 200 years ago or even 100 years ago as there are today.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with Gary Ferguson and Dr. Mary M. Clare about their work around the 8 master lessons of nature and full ecology. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. The other part of the book that really felt so relevant to today's times is a piece that you write, "And likely too, humans who build their success solely on the oppression of others may one day find their own feathered nests collapsing." You write about oppression and the consequences of this type of privilege and hierarchy. And I was just, can you just free associate for what this means for us? How we could use this time of COVID to really nurture a different approach and what that might be?
Well, in addition to creating a culture in much of the world that acts out of that separation thinking, as Mary and I like to call it, from isolating things for the purpose of study, we've also put an awful lot of emphasis on agentic, we could call it the archetypal masculine way of going through the world. And it's not that there's anything wrong with archetypal masculine energy. We all have it, whether you're a woman or a man. But the fact is, without a proper balance of feminine archetypal energy, and that brings with it an ability to see in terms of relationship, an ability to perceive the world in terms of cycles and circles. It sees past the individual thing to the energy that bonds it and connects it to the world in which it lives. So we've really lost or severely oppressed, I should say, a significant part of our wisdom by really denigrating for nearly 4,000 years the archetypal feminine perspective. The other thing I'd say that comes to mind is that the biggest predictor of any natural system being able to survive disruptions, and we too are going through a massive disruption right now, is the level of diversity it contains. Systems are able to come out on the other side of disruption and sometimes weave their communities in a way that they're stronger than they were before the upheaval happened. that diversity has much to say for us humans as well. And unfortunately, there have been so many people, whether they're indigenous people or African Americans, and the list is actually quite long, whose voices have been suppressed by those in charge or ignored at best. And by virtue of eliminating that kind of variety and that perspective that different lives bring to the world, we have thinned out our capacity to thrive, especially in the face, I would argue, of pandemics and other things that go wrong that cause a lot of upheaval. So once again, you know, all we need to do is calm down and look at what's going on around us. What is it that has made nature able to thrive through just extraordinary circumstances? Remember that we are that natural world, and then figure out how can we break down those walls that we've built between the human psyche and the natural world.
It's such a thrill for me to hear you talk about the human psyche. And that was the most exciting part of the book to me, which is lesson four, healing the planet and ourselves means recovering the feminine. So maybe this is a question for both you and Mary, is can you speak to the archetypal feminine, what that means, what that looks like on the ground, and really draw listeners into this type of framework?
Well, let me just start out by saying that on the ground, and the reason we know this, by the way, that this on-the-ground interpretation of the archetypal feminine is because we've been able to access lots of stories from cultures, some of them current and some of them who were living, you know, thousands of years ago. But those archetypal stories contain a lot of goddess images. So there's a strong feminine or female hero, if you will, in those tales. And those particular characters have a way of relating to things that are very different than the archetypal male energy. So, for instance, you would tend to be concerned from a feminine perspective of feeding and clothing all beings, while at the same time not needing to be master over them.
Yeah.
You would tend to be through the feminine lens, again, which we all have. This isn't just something that mm-hmm. you know, men are out of luck with. You would tend to be inclined to see how life does tend to occur in circles, whether it's from the seed being planted in the ground and later in the year the fruit finally happening, whether it's the beginning of life in the infant stage to the end of life and then finally passing away. There are a lot of cycles and circles that are part of that feminine perspective, and you need to only really look around you on the ground to see it even in non-human species. Wolves, for instance, are a great example of how the females are making most of the decisions for most wolf packs. And in fact, in mammals of roughly the same size around the world, it's the females who are often in charge as far as making decisions. This doesn't mean that the males aren't performing vital roles as well. But once again, if you really looked at the natural world, the notion of coming up with a one-sided set of stories that celebrates one aspect, one archetype, the male over female, would seem ridiculous.
And hi, Sarah. Thanks for including me in this conversation. Needless to say, Gary and I have spoken at length. We tend to walk a lot and talk a lot. And so we've thought through this whole Eight Master Lessons and now on into what we're calling full ecology. When it comes to the balance of the archetypal feminine and masculine, one of the things that always astonishes me is looking to the whole of this thing we call nature. So if you consider the whole planet, for example, and how well balanced it is and how absolutely generous it is. For example, not one human being can survive if it's not for water and air. So it's not surprising that story traditions have referred to the globe itself as the Great Mother, the mother who just looks after and provides and nourishes. But at the same time, and this is where it breaks from our experience as humans, the planet doesn't have any ego needs to be recognized. Well, like, oh, good job, planet, thank you so much. You know, I think that that works well if we can show that kind of honoring. But the other side of it is that the planet doesn't need particular species. It can sustain the species who show up and live out of their truest, most balanced nature. So there's quite the contingency, but it's a very loving, ultimately, contingency. So there's this big feminine that kind of stands then as the stage upon which agency happens. And in the case of humans, the agency of stewardship or the agency of destruction. And this flawed notion that we get to dominate it all from some superiority, which is not so helpful from the masculine archetype.
I was thinking maybe now is a great time for us to just transition into talking about full ecology. And Mary, you are officially called Dr. Mary M. Clare, and you're a social cultural psychologist, and you founded Full Ecology with Gary, which includes a training program on the 8 strategies for exploring reconnection to nature. And I have a very silly question to begin with, which is why the number 8? Why 8 master lessons and why 8 strategies?
Well, we like the number. It's got great symmetry. Just the way it looks. No, that's not why. It's just sort of by accident. And so these are the things that came forward as Gary was putting his book together. And then as we talked, we came to realize that there was another piece that was very much needed. And that is that for humans to reclaim our human nature, there is this fuller ecology to consider. And what makes full ecology full is alongside conservation science to take a good look at the ecologies between us and within us. Mm-hmm. These ones that are very near and very human. And that in that context, what do we do to help ourselves reconnect across 2,000 to 4,000 years of practice being separate, being pretty terrified in that, and making some agreements socially, mm-hmm. and bringing forward policies and actions that have not led us to a very good spot.
I want to name the 8 strategies in full ecology and land on the last one. So the first is connection, the second is variety, the third is balance, the fourth is relatives, the fifth is efficiency, the sixth is resilience, the seventh is elderhood, and the eighth is uncertainty. And this is the one that feels most relevant right now. And you write, to the extent we are able to embrace mystery, humans are able to live creatively and well with each other. So can you both speak to how you see this principle in action during this time of coronavirus?
Yes, that the first thing that comes to my mind is that when we accept uncertainty or mystery, however you want to call whatever you want to call it, you open yourself up to one of the great facts of life on Earth by any species that is successful, and that's the ability to improvise and to act appropriately in any given moment, given what the circumstances are that you find yourself in. The entire process of evolution is really adjustments being made to strengthen the relationship or the fitness of an individual and a community with what the circumstances are going on at any given moment. So while the mystery of COVID-19 is very unsettling, it also offers an opportunity for us to stop and really take stock of what's going on, what's our relationship to it, and what is being asked of us right at this moment. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that has driven the human species, and even Darwin was very aware of this, is our ability to be sympathetic with each other and to be connected. In fact, most anthropologists and evolutionary biologists would say that's the number one quality humans have that has allowed them to be successful, is their connectivity and their empathy and sympathy. What of that core genetic strength is being called forward in the face of a pandemic like COVID-19?
Mm-hmm. The other thing that, well, Gary and I find ourselves talking about how you're born. That's kind of guaranteed. If you're a human, you were born. And the next guarantee is that your body's going to drop. You're going to die. We don't like talking about that very much. Right. And in between birth and death, a lot of stuff happens. And it's all improvisation. And so that comfort, as Gary's saying, with uncertainty, also holds open and holds more softly the fact of our despair and our grief. Right now, with COVID-19 right in our face, we are, any day we get up, it's the next day of news of despair, news of grief. We cannot, and it has never been good for us to hold that at bay.
Yeah.
This is our companion. This is the nature of being in life. And so part of uncertainty is holding, it's hard to say it more lightly, Sarah, but that's really how it feels.
Yeah.
Holding despair,
yeah.
Holding grief more lightly,
yeah.
And allowing it to come along. Because if we push it away, we cut out our capacity to be naturally responsive, closer to our human nature.
I'm going to take two paths with what you've just said, Mary. I noticed in your first full ecology video update, which is on your website, you say human nature is made more unobstructed when we're in times of crisis like this. And Gary, in your book, The Eight Master Lessons of Nature, you tread fairly lightly around your own personal story, but you drop into it when you are describing the disruption when your first wife died in an accidental death. And you write in that chapter, disruptions can lead to healing. So if we were to sort of steer in the path toward the path of healing, what does that look like through despair and grief?
If I can, for a moment, link my own tragedy that you're referring to, when my first wife of 25 years died in a canoeing accident back in 2005, that would certainly qualify as what ecologists refer to in the natural world as disruption. Now, if you look at the natural world, and I'm going to come into my own life through nature, you see that there are actually two things that will predict how well an organism will be able to come through a disruption. The first is, does that particular being have an ability to kind of withstand the blunt force of whatever traumatic event happens? So out in nature, for instance, the ponderosa pine has strategized over many, many, many years that it can protect itself from wildfire by having a very thick bark that insulates it from the deadly effects of hot flames. It also will tend to drop its lower limbs so that when a healthy fire moves through the forest, it doesn't climb the ladder of those limbs and kill the tree by burning the crown. So it's kind of taken care of or strategized ways of avoiding the worst of the blunt force of the trauma. And then what happens after the event really depends a lot on whether the things that are essential for reweaving life, the new set of lives that make up the new community after the upheaval, have been protected and are in place. So out in that forest, again, you've got lodgepole pines, 20%+ of which have cones that only open in the intense heat of fire. They drop their seeds into the ashes, and with that nutrient-rich ash, they're able to get growing again. Do the microbes in the soil survive, and so they can continue to process nutrients for the plants that are coming back? Are pollinators nearby so that they can come in and pollinate the first flowering plants that recover in the burned areas? So in my case, I would ask, I would have to look at that tragedy through, or I choose to look at that tragedy, I should say, through similar lens. What was it that allowed me to not be completely destroyed by that terrible upheaval? Well, I would argue that it was in large part the relationship that I had built to the natural world over many years before then. Specifically, the qualities that nature has long been associated with by indigenous people of presenting, of reminding humans of. So that would be beauty, community, and mystery. Those are healing qualities, and I was able to access them after the initial event, and they helped that wheel of grief keep turning. And the other thing is, what would I need to come back? What would I need to build a new life afterward? Besides those things, I would need what humans very much need. Their entire mental health is dependent on it, and that's connection.
Yeah.
Not just with the natural world, in my case, but connection with other people. So was I able to have a community of people and non-humans that held me and that allowed me the time necessary to, as Mary said earlier, hold that grief as a reality? And so that's how I would respond to your question about my own personal tragedy.
And certainly that was an enormous disruption. Another thing I've heard in, as Gary's spoken about this, these are stories that you can only barely imagine unless you've been through something like it. And then even still, because everyone is different. But we all have experienced loss. No matter how old the person is listening to this broadcast, yeah. You know, you have experienced loss. And you have kept going. You're hearing these words now. So when I said that disruption brings us closer to our human nature, I meant that it really does strip us down. But here's a little corollary on that. It is necessary. Disruption is actually necessary for our hugely substantive growth, but it is not sufficient. And so the four steps of full ecology that bring us back to those eight lessons, the first one is to stop. And nothing stopped for Gary could have responded to this situation a lot of ways.
Yeah.
But he stopped. Just stop. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's for a long period, and sometimes it's for a fraction of a second. Just stop. And that gives the space to begin to hear what it is that you need to investigate before you act. One of the things that humans have been doing way too much and in harmful ways is jumping into action and answering, it turns out about 95% of the time, the wrong question because we so want to act and do something. And so the four steps that we have identified for full ecology showed up in Gary's recovery. Stopping, asking, investigating, what is it? How do I structure my life? And does that make sense? And then acting. And then following from that is the fourth one, which is to inspire. Mm-hmm. You don't have to do anything. You naturally inspire. And you're naturally more inspired mm-hmm. by virtue of being more consistent with your true human nature.
You've taken me right where I want us to be at this point at the end of the interview, which is I'm thinking about all the listeners out there who may be feeling a bit worn down or isolated or disconnected, who are chomping at the bit to get back out into, quote, nature. And you've offered these four steps, stop, ask, investigate, act, and then inspire. What heartens you these days, or what is inspiring to you that you might share?
Oh, the fact, Sarah, that we're talking about this.
Yeah.
Think of it. Even 10 years ago, I'm not sure this conversation would have come to us in this way.
Yeah.
We have had the habit of late, and certainly we're standing on the shoulders of giants with ideas like deep ecology and, with the work of Rachel Carson, we can just go back a long time and find that there have always been people who have been thinking somewhat in this way. But of late, we've been scaring ourselves to death with data.
Yeah.
We need to know the data, but we also need to know what it is about human nature or being off the path that got us into this mess. Mm-hmm. And really, it's this bad habit of separate thinking, of me first thinking. And we don't need to beat ourselves up about it, but we do need to start paying attention and catch ourselves when we're doing that and go, do I want to keep acting as if I'm totally isolated, living from that, or living from connection?
And I think one of the most heartening things that I would like to share is for us to remember as often as possible that human beings, like other life forms on this planet, are a success story. We are wired to have what we need to navigate what is in front of us, no less so than an elephant or a lion or a wolf. We have a reflective thinking capacity that can allow us to reopen our lives in even the most dire circumstances and carry on. And the second thing that I would wed to that particular heartening bit of memory that we're wired to succeed is the fact that we're sharing this planet with life forms that really do, as we said earlier, have our back. We're not alone. We're not alone with each other, and we're not alone with life in general. And so when we suffer in community. We always suffer in community, and we will rise again and find better days in large part because of that community.
Gary Ferguson is the author of 25 books on nature. He and his wife, Dr. Mary M. Claire, are founders of Full Ecology and live in Bozeman, Montana. Look for more information about Gary and Dr. Claire at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008, and thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis.